Good evening. I'm going to begin with a brief look at the story so far of tax devolution in Scotland. I'm going to look at some key dates and events and start with the 1997 devolution referendum, which demonstrated support for a Scottish Parliament with tax-raising powers. And this led to the setting up of the Scottish Parliament and also the passing of the Scotland Act 1998, which provided for a variable rate of Scottish income tax that was never actually used. We then had the Calman Commission review of the Scotland Act, and that led to the Scotland Act 2012. And this provided for greater tax powers, including the Scottish rate of income tax, and two fully devolved taxes, which apply from April 2015. That's Landowner Buildings Transaction Tax and Scottish Landfill Tax. And you can see we're getting a bit more devolved power. And then following the 2014 independence referendum and the Smith Commission, we got the 2016 Scotland Act, and that provided for Scottish income tax, assignment of VAT that starts from April next year, replacements for air passenger duty and aggregates levy, and the power to introduce new taxes. So the position we're in now, following Scotland Act 2016, is that devolved taxes represent about half of the money spent by the Scottish Parliament. Nevertheless, I'd say they actually give the Scottish Parliament only a small fraction of control and flexibility in terms of the overall tax regime. And this is partly because of the Scottish taxes themselves. They're a mixed bag in terms of their nature and in terms of the amount of revenue they deliver. So we've got fully devolved taxes, which are actually quite small in terms of revenues. We've got the shared Scottish income tax, which delivers a lot of revenue. The assigned VAT, which has no powers whatsoever and will deliver a large amount of income. And then there's the local tax, non-domestic rates. Council tax isn't included here. So the CIOT over the years has provided a lot of input on Scottish taxes, and together with ICAS, we formed the Scottish Taxes Policy Forum, and this published a discussion paper on October the 12th, devolving taxes across the UK, learning from the Scottish experience. And in that paper, we consider some of the consequences of tax devolution and what can be learned from them. So one aspect we considered was interactions with the UK-wide system. And I'm going to take Scottish income tax here as an example. So the powers to set rates and bands for Scottish taxpayers are shared between the Scottish and the UK parliaments. But the UK parliament has the power over the tax base, so it determines what counts as each type of income, what are deductible expenses, what the tax reliefs are and allowances. And importantly, it has control of the personal allowance. There's only around 4.5 million adults in Scotland in this current tax year, and only about 2.5 million of those are actually taxpayers. It's quite a small tax base. And of those, fewer than 350,000 are in the UK higher rate band, and only about 20,000 would be in the UK rate additional band. Median income in Scotland is only £24,000, so any increases in the personal allowance can significantly reduce not only the number of Scottish taxpayers and the Scottish tax base, but the income tax revenues. And so that can significantly constrain Scottish income tax policy decisions. The shared nature of the income tax also creates complexity and perceived unfairnesses for individual taxpayers. So, for example, we've got taxpayers who have both savings or dividend income and earned or rental income. They have to consider both UK and Scottish rates and bands. Scottish taxpayers who have earned income, they may have a joint effective tax rate for income tax and national insurance contributions if they've got income between the higher rate, the two higher rate thresholds, the Scottish and the UK higher rate threshold. That effective rate is 53%. Also, there's an effect on various tax reliefs, for example, relief at source on pension contributions, tax relief on finance costs, and the availability of marriage allowance. These are all things that that taxpayers may find unfair for them. And so these different factors, both on the policy side and for individual taxpayers, made us think about the question of whether the boundaries for sharing tax powers are correctly drawn. We also looked at issues of divergence and alignment between taxes. And although this varies from tax to tax, in all cases, the Scottish Parliament risks being accused of wasting its powers if it doesn't exercise them at all, as was the case with the Scottish variable rate, or if it merely mirrors existing UK legislation, which to a large extent it's done with Scottish landfill tax. And yet divergence often leads to concerns about uncertainty or behavioural responses. And that's perhaps reflected very well in the way the UK and the Scottish policymakers have reacted to each other's changes in respect of stamp duty land tax and land and buildings transaction tax. Now, alongside the Scottish Taxes Policy Forum paper, we also carried out some polling in late September. And this poll aimed to understand the attitudes of Scots towards tax devolution. And it was sobering, but not really surprising, to find that there was a low level of knowledge and understanding about the powers that were devolved, and also an overwhelming urge to see politicians provide people with more information. So what were those, the results of those poll? For example, 84% of Scots felt we need better information about how taxes are decided in Scotland. 60% believe the relationship between UK and Scottish taxes is difficult to understand. On income tax, 52% said they had little or no understanding of the definition of a Scottish taxpayer. Which is worrying in the sense that addresses are important. It's important to update HMRC with your address to ensure that taxpayers can be identified correctly. But there's no statutory obligation to do so, so it is important that taxpayers are aware of this. In terms of responsibilities, 66% were unaware that income tax is a shared tax and the responsibility of both the UK and the Scottish Parliament. And also 57% were unaware that land and buildings transaction tax is actually a fully devolved tax. So this shows that there's some confusion over which parliaments have responsibility for which taxes. And there may be various reasons for this, but it might involve the piecemeal nature of devolution. We've had a number of taxes be devolved over a number of years, but also this different types of devolution that I mentioned earlier, and also the fact that some of them lack profile and visibility because they only affect very few taxpayers. So what are the lessons that we can learn both from the paper and from the polling? There's some good practice in Scotland that could be adopted elsewhere, and in particular, the CIOT has welcomed the consultative and collaborative approach adopted by the Scottish Government. In terms of things that might be able to be improved, in general, devolution could benefit from a logical and consistent framework. So, for example, it might be worthwhile to have greater consideration of taxes that are suitable for devolution, taking into account factors like that David mentioned earlier. Consideration of the mix of taxes to ensure we're not overly dependent on one tax. It might be better to have more effective and transparent collaboration between each of the devolved governments and the UK government around tax policy negotiations. In terms of taxpayers, given the complexities they face and the uncertainties, this question of whether boundaries are drawn in the correct place and whether there should be more consistency or how that divergence should work, that there needs to be greater consideration of those questions. In respect of income tax, further consideration of the UK income tax framework and how the process of devolution dovetails into it to eliminate the unwanted consequences that we've come across. In Scotland, we're particularly interested in seeing a committee dedicated to the scrutiny of tax legislation in the Scottish Parliament to increase visibility of tax decisions, and also an annual finance bill process that we don't have in Scotland at the moment. But I'd like to end with one point that we've mentioned accountability in some of the earlier talks, and that is one of the reasons that's often given for devolution, is that it increases financial accountability. But given the polling results, it's unlikely that there is increased financial accountability at the moment, because there's a complete lack of understanding of who has responsibility for the different taxes. And so from that, our recommendation would be an improvement in awareness raising and provision of information to the general public.
Great. Thank you very much. So I'm not sure that I quite have the authority to speak for the whole of local government, given that combined authorities are quite a specific bit of local government that my boss would say it's not even part of local government. But what I thought I'd do was maybe set the debate in a bigger picture around how organisations like combined authorities think about how they pull together the funding mix to do the things that they were set up to do. So in terms of what I think the CA's role in this debate is, just try and understand a bit where we fit in. It's quite interesting, actually, because there have been a number of combined authorities who have been talking to the devolved nations around how they've set themselves up, their potential arrangements, exploring what opportunities there might be to kind of foray a bit further into this territory. So, you know, where do combined authorities fit in? Well, superficially, should be quite nice. They should fit in quite nicely, because they've got the democratic accountability of a mayor. They operate at a regional scale that broadly maps to economic geography. They have a core remit to support economic growth. But despite that clear mission, is there equal clarity on from where we derive the funding to deliver on that mission? So I think we come at it from that position of where are we going to get the resources from to do the job that we've been set up to do. And the practice of that is a lot messier than the theory. And I think, you know, the way it feels like it's worked over the last couple of years since the Combined Authority was set up, you know, it's a concept that's probably quite familiar to local government, of like marginal incrementalisation, basically. So just slowly moving in a kind of direction of becoming more devolved. So in the context of the Combined Authority, there is appetite to innovate. So when the original deal was signed, we had a gain share, so £36.5 million a year for 30 years, which we capitalised and combined with a mayoral precept and a business rate supplement to put together an investment programme to deliver, you know, the key connectivity and investment in the key things like skills that are going to unlock growth in our region. But it's been quite interesting. There's been a lot of talk around kind of which taxes you devolve, but in this context, it's additional revenue streams, not devolving existing ones, which I think is part of the problem in terms of the legitimacy from the public. Because I think people's instinct is that whenever you talk about devolved tax, they instantly think that must mean extra tax for me, not I'm paying it to a more local organisation. And it came with strings attached. So the mayoral precept has to be signed off by the constituent authority leaders, which makes it quite a tricksy process, as we learned last year, when they weren't minded to let it go forward. And it also then has to be framed towards existing mayoral power. So it instantly makes it a bit more complicated to work out, setting out exactly what it's paying for and to get through the process of getting it signed off. And similarly for the business rate supplement, so that is subject to a ballot of businesses, and again, it has to be framed in a programme that demonstrates the benefits that it will bring to the tax base. So big strings attached compared to some of the central government mechanisms. You know, so you've got issues of politics, consent, legislation, because the local government finance bill didn't go through as well, so another complication just to delivering what we thought would be in the mix when the original DVA deal was signed. So because of that, it feels like there's probably limited appetite and legislative time to go down a big fiscal devolution route at the moment. So a lot of our focus has been on, well, where do we get the resources from in grant terms? And actually, we've been quite successful from that point of view. We can tally up £500 million worth of funding that's been secured in the last year through a housing deal, through a second devolution deal, around skills, around 5G test bed, but it's delegated as opposed to fully devolved. And there's a lot of talk about local government capacity. So from a combined authority point of view, we're not constrained by a lot of the pressures that local government are experiencing, either from their tax base or from public service, you know, public services demands. But what we have had from all of those little mini deals on housing, on skills, 5G, each one of those grants comes with an extra set of strings, and, or not strings, but monitoring in terms of what it needs to deliver, how demonstrate how it's been spent. So the pressure that's loaded onto our core capacity to kind of feed those various machines in central government means that our capacity is quite under constraint at centre, and it makes it feel quite complex. It probably makes it feel quite opaque to your punter on the street. And just in terms of the general relationship with government, it's quite a transactional relationship. And I think it then tends the combined authority to look up to central government rather than look out to its citizens. I think that's the risk that we want to try and manage. Despite that, we're still up for innovation. So around our housing funds, we've got £600 million worth of housing funds through seven different streams, which we have managed to pull together into a single commissioning framework. But you're kind of trying to do it in spite of the tendencies of the system rather than because of them. And it comes back to this key question that I suppose Neil raised, which is, you know, are we equipped to deliver our core function? So as a broader environment for the combined authority, it's an environment that we're managing, but it doesn't feel like, probably like local government, it doesn't feel like it's sustainable over the long term. So then there's the question of, so this is where we are now, where do we want to be? Do we kind of agree that further fiscal devolution is the route that's going to deliver better economic, help us deliver better economic outcomes? So I think there are a number of things that combined authorities as a kind of group should be thinking about how we approach this broader debate. Firstly, I think it's about trying to have a different conversation with government. So trying to get away from the transactional, making devolution a process rather than an event, and one that usually happens around fiscal events. So the way we've been pitching our discussions with government is we want to make this a seamless, continuous conversation. How can we collaborate with government to deliver on shared priorities? How do we get away from the transactional? And there is space in that for some discussions around fiscal devolution. So, you know, we are in the very, very foothills of some discussions with Treasury around kind of what measures might work in helping secure some additional income streams. We are levering into that one, that conversation, saying, well, actually, we need to have conversations about devolving existing funding streams as part of that. But it is slowly moving to a different kind of conversation. I think, secondly, it's about recognising that it's going to need to be a blend of different things. So if we're going to be making the case for further fiscal devolution, then what role does other grant funding play in that mix? What role does kind of private sector investment play in that mix? What does that blend look like? So we've got a Funding for Growth Commission that is looking to bring those things together. So as well as exploring the kind of high principle, it's also very, very practically focused across kind of publicly and privately funded possible interventions that will actually help fill funding gaps on real programmes rather than kind of just the blue skies and the big principles. So that's one thing that we're doing. I think it's got to be about not missing opportunities. So a lot of time is being spent thinking about how the Shared Prosperity Fund is going to be constructed at the moment. At its worst, it could be a version of our experience today on steroids, where it's actually a nice ribbon, or maybe not a particularly nice ribbon, tied around existing funding streams. It's given a kind of wash of a Shared Prosperity Fund single pot rather than actually being one with proper discretion locally on what things are spent on. So we've got to get our act together on that, and I think that's a broader point around just we need to work together as a cohort with a united voice. So one of the things that I think has undermined the debate around fiscal devolution to date is the fact that, you know, there's been no shortage of fiscal commissions. You know, there was one in London, so as Tony Travis is not here, I'll trash him as well. But, you know, the easy thing to do is to come up with a self-contained package that says, well, you know, what you need to do, you just need to devolve stamp duty. It's like, that's a great idea for London. Completely doesn't work for the rest of the system. So if we're going to make a powerful case, we need to be able to demonstrate that we've considered what that means for how our tax system works as a system, rather than make special pleading for what we think will specifically work for a place or a sector. I think there's also a thing about getting form to follow function. So the debate around tax devolution can't happen unless we're talking about what public services are delivered locally as well. Because if you're going to give the public confidence, then them seeing that clear association between what they're paying and the difference that's making to what they're getting is going to be really important. And then I think the final thing is we just really can't forget that this conversation can't happen in a vacuum. There are some fundamental questions about how our broader tax regime is compatible with the way our economy is changing. We know that 2/3 of our tax revenue relies on three taxes: income tax, national insurance, and VAT. We've got an income tax system that's being hollowed out by increases in the personal allowance, which means that the tax base is getting smaller and smaller. We've got technology, which is dramatically changing how and where business takes place. We've got an aging society. We've got changing demands and expectations of public services. And we can't have a conversation around what we should devolve before having the first debate around, are we geared up to survive through, to kind of last through to the future. So I think it has to be not just about devolution and actually not just about growth, because I think an important part of that debate is the legitimacy of what is, as I've said before, what is funding public services. So I'd say I think there is an opportunity for a bold conversation. It feels like we are at a moment whereas previously it might have been quite easy, or the easier option is to kick this can down the road. I think with the context of local authorities, finance at the moment, it's quite difficult to do that. So it feels like there is a moment to have that kind of taking a step back and trying to set what is it that we're actually aiming for. So Bob Kerslake is chairing a commission, a 2070 commission, so to a 50-year time horizon, to try and think about the long-term end state. How do we reduce inequalities? I think fundamentally, the tax devolution debate has to be part of that broader conversation. What is it that it's trying to achieve? And if we can take the politics and the political cycle out of it, and if we can at least clearly define what the long-term end goal is, then even if we are proceeding in a route of kind of cautious long-term incrementalism, at least we'll then be having a conversation about how we get to an agreed endpoint rather than just an incrementalist approach that where we're not really quite sure where it's ending up. So it's a really, really interesting part of the debate, but I think from a combined authority point of view, there are other quite big kind of existential issues around what we do, how we fund it, and this is just one part of it. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Thank you to all of our speakers. There's tons of food for thought there. It strikes me that actually there's a fair amount of agreement, I think. I think we all agreed that there's kind of no right answer to whether we should or shouldn't devolve. There are pros and cons. David set out that there are, we can know in advance some things about different taxes, but I think Neil made a good case for needing evidence and needing to keep up to date with the evidence since it changes pretty quickly. We need to think not only about the taxes we devolve, but also about whether local government's up for the task, whether the public have support. I was struck about the idea that in Scotland, not only do we not know if they have support, a lot of them don't know what's even happening. I think we heard lots about the details of these things. Joanne set out how we need to think about boundaries between how we share taxes. I think Julia gave us a great deep dive into lots of the big questions we should ask when it actually hits the ground. It was music to my ears when Julia said we should think about the system as a whole. Yes, we should do that. And I guess what I'm thinking is, how do we make sure local governments are equipped for the challenges we're setting them up for? How do we get more coordination between central governments, local governments, devolved governments to answer some of these big questions about not just what do we devolve, but how do we do it on the ground? So that's my big question. Over to you guys. What are your big questions? I'll take a few at a time. Yep. If you could say who you are, and then I can keep your comments and questions brief.
So thank you very much for asking me a question about the detail of academic work. It's a pleasure, it's great. So you know, I guess the point you made, which is exactly right, is that it's very hard in these studies to work out if fiscal devolution is having an effect, given that we tend to devolve fiscally when certain conditions exist. So in the UK, we have relatively high regional inequality, so we're thinking of fiscal devolution as now as a potential solution for that. And this creates a causality problem, and there are lots of ways of dealing with that. People use instrumental variables. I appreciate no one here cares about instrumental variables apart from me, maybe Helen and David.
We care.
But, you know, for the geeks, you know, use these instrumental variable approaches, and they tend to be not very good. So maybe maybe there's some sort of truth in that. The other thing is that all of those studies, they tend to use really similar data sets. So, you know, there tend to be, three or four data sets which are used by all of these studies. Having said that, I mean, your final point here around, your second question about sort of what exactly is driving it, is this about sort of lower taxes or anything like that? I don't think we've got a clear picture. And I think that's kind of problematic, given how important these sort of questions are. The danger is that we end up so focused on the nuance and the detail of how it's not a danger. We end up being really focused on the sort of nuance and the detail of these things. So there you go.
David, you've got a quick point.
Yeah, so if I can add up very briefly on that, I agree with all what Neil said then. I think there's kind of like two particular issues with this kind of analysis. First is that a lot of it is quite what we'd kind of call reduced form. It's kind of a bit of a black box, what's going on in some of these kind of estimates. So often what they'll do is they'll just look at the relationship between the percentage of tax revenues that are devolved and outcomes. But you can devolve different percentages of the tax revenues, but there could be a different tax mix, there could be different rules about how much redistribution you have between areas that have low tax bases and high tax bases. And a lot of that isn't unpacked in literature. So I think there's a lot more room for kind of, you know, improved evidence on just actually how are these different factors playing out. You know, is it just tax devolution per se? Because is it to do with the accountability and issues like that? Or is it kind of the nature of the taxes being devolved? Or is it the nature of the kind of incentives being devolved? How much of the incentive is kind of taken away by fiscal equalization? So I think there's still a lot we don't know about this issue.
There's probably a case to be made for, you know, we can see that that our centralized system is still creating massive inequality. So, you know, raise the issue of Detroit, where, you know, you could make the case for Blackpool and say, well, actually, our current centralised system is also failing places. So, you know, what is the burden of proof that we need to see the impact to decentralise, or should the reverse be the case?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my conclusion was partly that, you know, it's probably not going to do any harm, right? You know, we've tried centralisation. Things haven't, you know, things aren't terrible, but they're not as good as they could be. You know, if the studies coalesce around zero, and, you know, there's actually other good evidence. I mean, there's good evidence that people are happier in more devolved countries because they feel like they're part of sort of decision-making processes. You know, maybe this is, well, I don't know if you feel that in Scotland. I mean, I don't feel it in London. But there is some evidence of that. So maybe there are sort of wider, tangible benefits of this sort of thing.
So we can collect data now so we can evaluate. I go over here and I come over here. Yeah. Great, okay, I'll take a question in the middle as well.
So this question returns to the previous one. Is the data and the literature mainly looking at how different systems operate with their degree of dispersion of power as it currently exists, or is it the process of devolution? In the sense that I'm intrigued to know, to what extent will the Switzerland and Germany distort your data set? Whereas if you're capturing the process of change in countries that aren't like Switzerland and Germany, and I make another observation, I'm becoming increasingly cautious their statistics and reliability, and where dummies can put in where there's the reported data for truth.
Great. So now, should we start with the sort of technical question, then we can throw it open about what do we do about Martin's property tax question?
So you say we should be cautious about studies, and I completely agree. You know, it's very hard to tease out the sort of causal effect here. And, you know, so, and particularly given some of the countries which are included in there, absolutely. I mean, some of them, you know, if we're looking at the OECD, some of these studies will include countries which are very different to our own, even the United States. I mean, I just think it's sort of very, it's very different. You had another point just before that, which I... Oh, the levels,
should really look at the process of change, or does it actually look at the degree to which they're centralised or decentralised? That may include long-standing economies, because some of the sorts, I think, of Germany and Switzerland.
Studies look at both in all sorts of different sort of identification strategies. Yeah, studies look at both, so... Yeah, I'm afraid I'm not going to be much more help. I mean, they sort of, it used to be, these studies, when I was a student studying this, we were told that, you know, essentially this is negative. Decentralization is going to have a negative impact, and those were mostly cross-sectional studies. The more recent studies where they look at change, they seem to be a little bit more positive. That's my reading of the literature.
Great. Okay, so now to Martin's question. Should we crack on with fixing property taxes at the centre, or let the local and devolved governments have a bash? Do you want to start, David, and then...
Yes, go on. I think that's kind of an interesting question. So there's a reason why we didn't talk, I didn't talk about kind of the form of existing property taxes. It's because we've been talking about that for a long time at the IFS. Not much has happened with it. But I actually do think there's some more opportunity to have a form of local taxes in the next few years, actually. The Welsh government is committed to examining a form of property taxes. It's considering revaluation. It's considering reformation of council tax, so it, you know, becomes more proportional to property value. Just today, I think the Scottish Greens have said they might vote down the Scottish budget if the SNP doesn't progress with plans to reform property tax. And we saw with things like stamp duty land tax, that sometimes changes in one devolved nation can catalyse change in others. Well, I think we also saw with property tax in Wales, that a change that's perceived to be botched can kind of stymie reform. So when they revalued council tax in Wales in 2005, I think they actually did, you know, put Labour off reforming for doing the same in England. They put on hold the revaluation then. So I think actually there's more chance of getting something done in the next couple of years than it has been for quite a while. Whether we have more chance if we devolve it to local areas or not and then have reforms, I'm not sure. So that is kind of the case that's been put forward by, I'll mention him again, Tony Travers. third mention, we can't have an event about devolution and not mention Tony Travers at least six times.
Halfway.
We're halfway there, so we'll have another three times, yeah. So... he says, actually, what you should do, you know, essentially, there's a block to reform. If you devolve this to somewhere like London, you devolve it to the areas, they will actually make the reforms because there's an appetite to do it at a local level because they see it as a chance to raise additional revenues. That's potentially the case. But I also see there to be an issue with this is that, you know, we've traditionally had quite a redistributive system of local government finance. If you start devolving... council tax to the local level, do you rip up that system of devolution? Do you say that actually if London now revalues council tax, you get to keep all the, you know, and you have higher values, you get to keep the additional revenues, or you can set lower council tax rates going forwards? Or do you say actually, well, you know, we're going to continue to take some of the revenue off you and give them to the rest of the country? In which case, why would London ever decide to do evaluation if it knows that some of the revenues it gets are going to then go to the north? So I think we can't really answer that question until we decide actually how redistributive do you want the tax system to be. If we want it to continue to be redistributive, I think you need to reform centrally before you start devolving additional powers down to the local level.
I guess to Julia and then Jermaine, from your perspective, would you rather have the government fix it first, then devolve it out, or would you rather just be given the powers and do your own thing locally?
I think it's probably a cop-out, but it has to be a combination of both. And I think, we've seen through the ways in which kind of the revaluation of business rates has kind of been explored and then stepped back from, you know, you just see that writ even larger with a council tax revaluation. So I think it's really, really, in a world where fiscally it's going to be very, very, very constrained, if you can't let any of that wash, if you've got no option to let it wash through the system, it's going to be politically very, very, very painful to do anything other than kind of keep trying to keep alive a very old system that it just makes life progressively more and more difficult for local government. So I think there has to be some kind of willingness at the centre to bite that bullet. But I think, the risk is, thinking about the political environment we're in now, but actually just generally the lifetime of the political cycle, if you give a Treasury minister the option to kick the can down the road for another cycle or to deal with it right now, then they will choose the option of kicking the can down the road. And I think what will be interesting is whether any parts of local government will fall over before kind of the acknowledgement of whether there's a need for more fundamental change gets faced up to. But I'm sure local government will be up for it. But I just, it's very difficult to do anything meaningful without the consideration of that broader system, I don't think.
Did you want to add anything, Joanne?
Yeah, I mean, in Scotland, we've had a commission on local tax reform a few years ago that was to look at council tax, and this probably leads into the Greens' position as well, because at the end of the day, it just ended up in no reform other than the very slight changes to the top bands. And then we've just had the Barclay review on non-domestic rates in Scotland. And again, it's led to fairly minor changes to the overall system, but with some chances to do things locally. So some local authorities will have the power to introduce pilot schemes to tax online businesses, for example. And what that has resulted in, interestingly, is, but perhaps not surprisingly, is a lot of pushback from businesses because they don't want to see differences between each local authority. And I think that is one of the issues that's always going to arise if you have differences between the local authorities. In Scotland, it is very redistributive. They all raise their own amounts, but it all goes back to the centre and is actually quite a centralised system at the moment.
And I think it's easy to forget, just that, council tax is a tax that people pay. They get a bill, you pay it out of your net income, mm-hmm. and I think it feels different. So you are more sensitive to changes, perhaps, than mm-hmm. you will be in small things at the margin that might impact what comes through in your payslip.
John, another question over here, someone, John.
Shortly actually moving the way you live, but a shift in the way that you take your income.
there's a question. I think they're back somewhere. Yeah. Yep.
Sorry, Denise, I think about 14 mentions. Are you still looking at mentions? So, I've got questions. So, let's believe about fiscal federalism, which probably correct voice gave in the EU, and which is a literature I haven't really referred to in the discussions today. Like, one example is that, like, take social care for example. Like, social care is highly redistributive as a service, yet it's funded on a very local base. And maybe that should be funded on local taxes, but if that's the case, it should be a local responsibility. I'm not saying, and that's probably a very political call, no matter what Julie was talking about earlier. So that's the question in terms of, can we consider this impact? Like, we have to consider not just taxes, but also, to some extent, what exactly local areas do, and also equalization, when they said that's involved, as a part of the piece, rather than just continue focusing on that.
Great. Okay, so perhaps, Julia, do you want to pick up on the kind of our taxpayers' distraction? Do you have technical expertise? Yeah. Maybe I'll come to you, Joanne, on getting Scottish income tax right and then we'll end off fiscal federalism.
Yeah. And then I think on the last point, you're right that, you know, that social care is a good example of it being very locally redistributive, but it does prompt me to think that actually if you analyse where local council revenues are spent and the proportion of the local population that they touch, you find that a disproportionate amount of that spend is focused on, and increasingly as you pull back into just providing statutory services, it becomes focused on a smaller and smaller group of higher and higher dependent people and young people. And so is there a point at which the compact at that local level, I pay my council tax and actually all I see is that my bins get collected once a fortnight if I'm lucky, as opposed to, you know, the all the kind of universal services, whether they're libraries, parks, all of those things feel like they're pulling back. Does that disrupt the kind of consent upon which kind of our council tax system is based? And then I think on the tax versus powers, if you're saying to me, if I had a choice between cash now or a long-term revenue stream, I think, you know, you can understand maybe why people get distracted by it, because that is quite a big prize if you think you're going to get a more buoyant, sustainable, long-term revenue stream rather than being dependent from settlement to settlement or kind of, you know, immediate government priority to priority. So it feels like a more sensible, you know. So if there was an alternative which was a longer-term settlement that maybe didn't involve tax powers, then I'd be up for that conversation, I'd be happy not to be distracted. But I do think, you know, it's quite an important principle that probably is why we still talk about it, even though the progress that we make is quite slow.
Great.
Joanne,
has got
no
screen up in
contact. it's certainly, I feel that it is very, very constrained in terms of what it can do. I would agree with that. But in terms of the behaviour, I think the likelihood of migration is probably restricted to a very few people who are highly mobile and high income. In terms of changing type of income by incorporation, if you're self-employed, for example, sometimes I feel that maybe the risk is a bit overstated in Scotland, because as I pointed out, there's only less than 350,000 higher rate taxpayers and only 20,000 additional rate. So they're really the people that are going to benefit most if they're self-employed from doing that. And the question is whether they're self-employed, because obviously we also know from other sources that a large proportion of the self-employed across the UK are actually very low income earners as well. So it's potentially quite an overstated problem, as maybe that study proves, and I think it's probably overstated in Scotland as well.
David and Neil, do you have any burning points, or should we move?
Well, can I take just that question very quickly, which is that I'm a little bit more pessimistic about people sort of moving around, and the reason for that is that my in-laws are staying with me, and my in-laws are from Scotland, and in Scotland they have minimum alcohol pricing. And the first thing my father-in-law did was come down and buy 4 bottles of whiskey, because it's much cheaper. And this tells you 2 things. It tells you, first of all, that people do respond to these sort of incentives, and it also tells you that all of the clichés about Scottish people are true.
But it's slightly different to buying a few bottles of alcohol when you're down on holiday. It's actually up sticks and moving and then having the possibility to change.
But it just takes a few companies or a few of the sort of main taxpayers to move, and you've made a sort of significant dent.
Mm-hmm. Have a quick point, then we'll do our questions.
Okay, so very quickly, I was going to say on the income tax question, you're right that kind of there's a big issue about avoidance. I think the issue there, one of them relates to the fact that dividends income is taxed at the UK rate and labour tax, labour income at the Scottish rate. I think that's actually, as you start to see a bigger and bigger divergence between the Scottish rate, could you see kind of more tax motivated than corporations in Scotland? On the migration point, the evidence in the US is actually quite mixed. So my reading of the evidence actually is that where you've got areas that have very big agglomeration effects, so you've got kind of the big cities like New York, LA, those are magnets, and people don't really leave those magnets for kind of tax reasons. Or you need quite big, you need a very strong magnet to pull them away from those existing magnets. And in part of that is actually because it's been capitalised into house prices. If taxes were lower in LA and New York, house prices would be more expensive. So, and house prices are bid up in the areas with lower taxes, sort of moving to. Where you see more migration is where you haven't got those agglomeration effects and you haven't got such constraint on the supply of property and land. So you often do see more migration effects from not the kind of core US cities, but the secondary US cities. And also I think evidence from like Switzerland actually suggests there's more migration going on there. So you have more local level tax variation. So maybe, say, Scotland, where you've got Edinburgh, Newcastle, and then nothing for 50 miles in between. It could be more of an issue for Wales, where in Wales, I think something like 90% of the population of Wales lives within 50 miles of the border, and 16 million people in England live within 50 miles of the border, and 7% of Welsh commute to jobs in England. And, you know, a similar number, not a smaller percentage, commute to jobs in Wales. So I think it could be more of an issue there. On that last question we had, the point you raised there about thinking about not only taxes, but also what you're devolving, I think is actually a really, really important question. You raise social care, and I think that's an important one, because on the one hand, government is making the local government finance system less about redistribution. It's business rates of attention, there's no longer the annual updates to needs assessment, so local areas have been asked to bear more of the spending risk, but the government wants more consistent standards of social care across the country. It's putting new requirements on social care, new minimum standards, etc. I think we really need to actually think for some services, you know, what is it we think is a local responsibility? Where we think local areas can do better if they have powers, where we're happy to be variation because that's local discretion. And other things, we think, no, these are citizens' rights. These are the things that matter if you're British. You know, you have schools, you have hospitals, you have social care, whatever you think the list is. I think we need to have that big conversation that Julie mentioned. Rather than just thinking about this tax by tax, issue by issue, you know, referendum by referendum, what can we do to kind of like, you know, short the system? Do we need, you know, that kind of great thing we used to have years and years ago, the Royal Commission, that actually says, look, let's actually do a kind of a kind of first principles look about what kind of country we want to be, what should be local, what should be national, and how do those relate to each other?
Great.
I've got a question which can only be characterised as an institutional or a process question, and then you'll see it's entirely impartial. I'm on Sam Weaver, and between 2004 and 2011, I'm responsible for HMRC policy on income tax and national insurance. I worked very closely, obviously, with the Treasury teams on the chairs. I was also responsible for the world taxation. Now, one of the things that happens to me is that all the work on the world taxation, if I just pick on a subset of my responsibilities, within the Treasury and HMRC, was handled by a tiny number of people. And what I look at now, in terms of what's happened, I left the responsibility and moved on to other responsibilities after the Carbon Commission reported. margin of the national system because it does actually enable this kind of transfer and equalization of income and expenditures.
Great, thank you, Sam. I think that's a kind of a good question for us to end with. I'm going to abuse my position as chair and kind of ask an additional question to all the speakers to say, so, also with Sam's, if you were a master planner, what would you currently conclude about devolution? And on the bold assumption that you're going to conclude that it's not perfect, of all the things we've talked about tonight, what's the one biggest thing you'd like to see happen, the conversation you'd like to see happen, the power to government, what do you want to see happening in this space? So should we just start randomly at the end of the table and move down?
So like your specific question around what's the cost-benefit analysis? Well, there's probably not an awful lot of cost in the system considering this in the West Midlands Combined Authority at the moment, and probably not a lot of benefit either. The thing that I would take away, I think it is just the need to pick through the interdependencies on all of this. I think there isn't going to be one big, bold, transformative thing, and also just really start where the public are. And, you know, we've had some quite interesting statistics about how Scottish taxpayers understood the system. I think if you did polling of the existing UK tax system or even the existing local government funding system, you'd see probably broadly comparable. So is it a devolved thing or is it that we've got a massively complicated tax system that nobody understands?
David?
Okay, yeah. So on the cost-benefit issue. So I think it kind of depends on the starting point you have. So take an example of local government finance, for instance. We had a system that for years was ultra redistributive. You know, effectively all the money got kind of paid, you know, council set council tax and kept it, and they could have higher or lower council tax, but there was full equalization according to the size of the tax bases. And full equalization according to how much spending needs you had. So, you know, you get poorer, you get richer, that gets offset by changing how much grant money you have. So, of course, that provides very little incentive for you to do anything. And you can kind of change the system to provide incentives. That doesn't mean you need full devolution. It provides some kind of assignment, like you have with business rates retention. And you can do something similar with income tax or with VAT. You can have assignment to local areas or assignment to devolved governments. But I think devolution starts to kind of pay its way, if you like, when it comes to you know, paying for the extra costs of the extra analysts and policymakers and administration. Is, you know, it's not kind of any, you know, scientific rule here. It's my kind of own gut feeling. It's when you have a when you want to do something different at that level, when you want to actually raise revenues or, you know, raise less revenues, when you want to actually have a more progressive system or a less progressive system. I think we've seen that in Scotland. The Scottish government has actually, you know, raised revenues and it's made it more progressive. You might see something similar in Wales, where I think that there's less, you know, if it's only about the incentive, you don't need to go to the whole host of devolving. Actually, the assignment can give you that incentive without those extra costs. I also think it depends on the taxes as well, you know, so that's why I said, you know, property tax, income tax, the issues around administration, that they get really much more complicated when you get to sales tax, VAT, corporate taxes, things like that. On Helen's question, what would I like to see in this area? I guess I would like to see it, this area of devolution actually looked at, from a first principles basis, as I just mentioned now. I feel like a lot of the discussion is around, you know, tax by tax, or it's around, you know, we've identified this problem, you know, we think there's a problem of tanning, too much tanning salons and skin cancer in the South Hills Valley, so we'll have a tanning salon tax. Rather than actually thinking about actually how the system works as a whole and what do you want to achieve in local government. So actually, you know, as I said, going back to the kind of almost constitutional debate that we should have had, you know, 20 years ago when devolution kicked off, but actually starting that now.
Right.
Okay. So cost-benefit analysis question. I think, interestingly, if I look at Scottish devolution, then obviously Scottish income tax is dealt with by HM Revenue Customs, and I think that is, at the moment, is obviously the best route forward. So from that point of view, I think accepting that there are constraints on the Scottish Government, the Scottish Parliament's powers over income tax, then that actually has provided the benefit for the best cost solution as well. So I think there you have got a decent outcome. And I think Revenue Scotland, because it's a small operation at the moment, just dealing with the two devolved taxes, is actually working and doing quite well. So probably from a Scottish point of view, actually, because they have thought about what mechanisms they want to use for what devolved taxes and why, then actually the cost-benefit analysis has actually probably played out reasonably well so far. In terms of what I would like to see happen, I think I would go back to my lessons to be learned and say that I really think that overall devolution could benefit from a logical and consistent framework, because the piecemeal approach isn't helpful in terms of getting understanding. And also, while it might be appropriate to have the different types of devolution that we have in Scotland at the moment, with assigned taxes, fully devolved taxes, and partially devolved taxes, there are questions about whether those are the most appropriate routes for those particular taxes. And particularly now with income tax, there is potentially an argument that actually Scotland should have power over the savings and dividend income tax bands and rates, if not the base. Partly because I believe one of the reasons why it wasn't given powers over those to start with was, for example, the fact that we had deduction at source of tax from bank interest, which of course doesn't occur anymore. So those kind of questions could be looked at.
Right, Neil.
So, I mean, I think it's a great question about cost-benefit analysis, and I think you've nailed why, in these studies, why they show that fiscal devolution reduces regional disparities, and it's because you start off with you start off with lots of rich tax lawyers in London, and you finish up with rich tax lawyers everywhere. And I think that's great. So, you know, that probably explains these studies. And then on your point about what we should do next, I don't know. So I would do the political thing, and I would have a commission, and I would have it run by Tony Travers.
Excellent. Okay, so I think what's really depressing is that despite the fact that we've actually come quite a long way with devolution, the universal opinion seems to be that we still need to go back to first principles, have a logical framework, pick through all these independencies and work out what the hell we're trying to do, which obviously is great news for us. That's exactly what we do at the IFS, so we are not going out of business anytime soon. Come back and listen to more of the debate that I'm sure we'll be having. Thank you very much. There will be drinks outside. Lots of us will be around, so please hang around and talk to us. But for now, thank you to all our wonderful speakers.